Hello, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast powered by Ignition Coach Co. I'm your host, Adam Sabin, and in this week's show, we're talking about cross-training in preparation for cycling events, variations between running and cycling power numbers, and how to fuel those early morning workouts. Today's show is also brought to you by Flow Formulas. Spring is in the air, which makes for a great time of year to get on top of your nutrition game. Head over to flowformulas.com today and make sure to use the discount code MATCHBOX when checking out. As always, if you like what you hear, please share this with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if you have any questions for the show, you can drop us an email at matchboxpod@gmail.com with email titled The Matchbox Podcast, or you can head over to ignitioncoachco.com and fill out the Matchbox Podcast listener question form. All right, let's get into it. All right, first question here this week comes in from Ryan. Ryan says, I am a multi-sport fun hog, not really focused on racing, but have begun to take an interest in endurance, mountain, and gravel racing events. How should I incorporate my activities into training for faster cycling performance over endurance events? I trail run and do a fair amount of hiking and paragliding, which is often short distances but thousands of feet of vert over an hour or two. I notice my estimated power output for running is considerably higher than my cycling FTP. Does this mean that I am sandbagging when I am on the bike, and should I try to base my training efforts off of my running power? For example, Exert thinks my threshold power is 378 watts based on running activities, but the best that I have been able to manage from cycling has been 230 watts based on a 20-minute FTP. Just got a power meter for the first time recently and a drop bar bike for the first time in over a decade. Thanks, Ryan.
I feel like the technology is just too new. As far as running power, that's typically what I see, like a solid 50 to 80 watts higher on my pretty chill runs than on a zone 2 ride. So wow.
Just so people know, what running power meter are you using?
I just have my Garmin and it estimates it. I don't have the Stride pod or anything. Okay. But it says it takes into account wind, elevation, speed, cadence, all of those metrics, and it just seems like a lot and very fuzzy, the algorithm. I don't really understand it. Okay.
Whereas why do you need cycling power for running? That seems like an unnecessary thing, in my opinion. Like, I know pace is kind of old school, but I feel like with pace and with heart rate, I feel like that's a better, I don't know. Power just doesn't seem like a thing that you would need, and you're not putting it's pretty clear in cycling, you're producing power into the cranks, right? And that's
it's super measurable.
You're running, you're putting power into the ground. How is that how in the world? And it's like you're just doing like little clips of it when your feet hit the ground. I'm just trying to think, like, that doesn't seem to work. And I don't see how that would work, but
maybe I like the pace. I like the grade adjusted pace. I think even that was pretty interesting when that came out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. See, that's what I was trying to get with like heart rate is like, obviously when the terrain goes up, you need to adjust your pace. But if they have grade adjusted pace, then that answers that.
Does your Garmin watch, because I have never used like a fancy running watch before. Does your Garmin watch give you real time gap or grade adjusted pace?
It might. It probably is a feature that I can add to one of the workout pages, but I've not. I don't see that till after.
Okay.
But I'm sure you probably can.
I guess we should try to answer this guy's question. What exactly was his question?
Well, again? I think Caitlin started to, you know, he wants to know why is there such a big discrepancy between his running estimated power and his cycling estimated power?
Yeah.
And I think Caitlin, what you're saying is if he's using something like a Garmin watch that is truly just estimating your running power, it's probably inflated. Now, Ryan here, he's using Exert. I didn't know that you could use Exert for running, so that's kind of cool. That's something new to me. He says that Exert estimates his running power to be 378 watts, while cycling power is 230 watts. So that's a 150 watt difference, which is pretty vast. And sounds like Ryan just got a power meter too. So that's actually based on a power meter. That's not estimated power.
His power on the bike is not estimated, you're saying?
Correct.
Does he say if he's a former runner? I'm assuming he comes from running and he's getting into cycling.
Ryan doesn't say what his background experiences in sport, but just that Ryan enjoys multi-sport activities. So trail running, paragliding, so he says a fair amount of hiking for paragliding. So I'm guessing he has to hike to certain spots for takeoff and landing, nice. Something like that. I don't know much about paragliding. So I don't,
that sounds like a spy or something. That's all I can think of.
James Bond up in paragliding.
Anyways, the reason I was asking was because I could totally see a big discrepancy between those two things if he came from running, because if he's done way more running in the past, then his body has just gotten really efficient at running.
Yeah.
And so he could probably get a lot more out of himself when he's running versus cycling. And there is a lot of carryover, but when you just jump on a bike after having ran your whole life or something, you're not going to be quite as efficient. It takes developing those, if you, I don't know, I think of like myelin in your brain. There's a whole book on how skills are developed or talent is developed. I think the book is called The Talent Code, but it's all about wrapping myelin sheathing around all of your nerve connections in your brain. So the more you do something, the more those connections get wrapped with myelin, and the more they get wrapped with myelin, the better those nerve connections are able to fire off and you know, work together. And so obviously all of that's been built and built and built if you've been running for years, and you are now starting to build those networks, I guess, with cycling. So it's not going to be as efficient if you wanted a brain perspective, I guess.
Sure.
That's what I was thinking, is like just basically just efficiency.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would say too, if you're using something that's just estimating your running power, like now I'm kind of curious to like go in and see, like if I upload my running workouts to Exert, I'd be curious to know like what it says for me, just so that I could see like, is there this much of a discrepancy? But I would think too, like if it's just estimating, your weight has to be updated very regularly, because it's going to be using weight. Mm-hmm. It's going to rely on weight heavily to form that estimate. And also you have to do some amount of workouts that simulate a threshold workout too. So I don't know what kind of workouts Ryan's doing that would formulate those kind of estimates. But I would just say like, if you're using estimates and you're trying to compare from one modality to another, it's probably just too complicated. And there's too much of a discrepancy there. Even if, let's say, you were using a power meter for running, like you were using a Stride power meter or one of the other ones, and you did have a solid estimate of what your actual running threshold was, I still wouldn't use that. It's just not transferable. They're just different things. And I think I haven't used running power enough to really understand or know how it correlates to cycling power, but you have to just keep it. Your running power is your running power. You use that referenced only for running, and then vice versa for cycling. And I would even go so far as to say, like, there are certain times or certain situations where even your cycling power might be specific to, let's say, a certain bike or a certain setup, or definitely time of year. That's why we do periodic check-ins with your threshold, just to update your zones, because it's not a constant. That's going to be a moving target always. Even within a training block, it might be moving on you. So it's just something, it's kind of there as a reference point, but I definitely would not say you should try to correlate the two different modality thresholds that you're working with here.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan also kind of mentions or asks how should he incorporate all these other activities into training for cycling performance, for some of these longer endurance events that he signed up for, mountain and gravel. So, you know, kind of wondering like, how can he sort of cross train as part of his training program for these other events, cycling events?
I mean, depending on what his goals are in these cycling events, I mean, there's, you know, always multiple ways to skin a cat. I mean, you can run 3 days a week if you want, do your hike on the weekends, and make your intensity days, make your workouts on the bike. I don't know if he's training he did say he's training for mountain events. Yeah.
Mountain and gravel endurance events. Yep.
So, I mean, part of that is feeling good on the bike and your handling. So I would say get at least 3 rides on the bike. So both intensity days are on the bike, and then you're having a day where you're really focusing on the skills, if that's something you're not super familiar with. But yeah, I mean, running's going to give you a great aerobic base, but I see a lot of runners that have come over to cycling and are like, oh my gosh, they're going to be so fast. They have like this huge aerobic engine, but they just don't have the power in the legs. And that's like an efficiency thing as well as just the strength in the legs to push the power. So I would also recommend being in the gym and, you know, not too close to an event if you're not used to being in the gym, but squatting, deadlifting, things that are going to build muscular strength are going to go a long way on the bike.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. To apply the rule of specificity, I like doing running, and if this dude wants to paraglide and just do all this other aerobic stuff, but I would do that earlier in the season throughout the base period, and then as he gets closer and closer to his bike races, more and more time should be dedicated to bike training. So maybe he's doing like 50-50 other activities in cycling during the base season. And then as he gets closer and closer to his A race, maybe that starts to shift to like 90% of his stuff is on the bike and like only 10% of it is these other activities he likes to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And that doesn't have to be a super long period. Like, let's say you've got a big gravel race in at the beginning of June, say Unbound. It could just be the 3 or 4 weeks leading up to that, where you just want to really hone your cycling skills and let your body get really used to those adaptations and not get kind of confused trying to make adaptations for other disciplines. And then you can go right back to incorporating some of those other multi-sport modalities after that. But you know, the 3 to 4 weeks preceding these events, I agree, spending more time. And that goes even, you know, more specific within cycling. You know, you said that you've got gravel and mountain bike events that you're training for. I would spend those 3 to 4 weeks when you're doing more specific work cycling. I would do that on the bike that you plan on riding. So if it's a mountain bike race, ride the mountain bike for those 3 or 4 weeks. If it's a gravel race, ride the gravel bike for those 3 or 4 weeks. And then again, yeah, when you kind of revert back into that base or, you know, maintenance mode in between those events, then you can mix it up and ride off-road, on-road, dirt, gravel, doesn't matter. You know, mix in some trail running and hiking and other modalities. But yeah, try and get pretty specific for those 3 to 4 weeks leading up to the races.
I'll be kind of blunt here. If I was coaching this guy and he was telling me like what his running FTP was, I would say, why does that matter? Like if you're trying to train for mountain bike races or gravel races, like I don't think you like, why? I don't know. Why do you care about your running FTP? I would just focus on the cycling FTP. Because if that's where your goals are, then do that. And then if you're using running as a training modality, then you're probably just doing a lot of endurance running anyways. And I think you just use heart rate from that. And you don't really need to have that whole running power thing.
Yeah, personally. I would 100% agree with that. The only reason you would use threshold for running would be if you're trying to do threshold workouts or super threshold workouts and try and track that. But otherwise, yeah, I agree. You know, heart rate's going to be much less of a moving target, and especially your zone 2 heart rate, your threshold heart rate for running or cycling, that might fluctuate throughout the season based on your how fit you are. But your zone 2 is pretty much going to stay pretty constant throughout the season. So you should always know exactly what your zone 2 runs should feel like. And I even like myself, I like basing my runs even more so off of RPE at times, because I actually find if I run off of heart rate, sometimes I'm actually running harder than I even want to. Whereas if I just go off of RPE, I'm going to keep, like, it's really easy for me to keep zone 2 RPE for running. Never feels hard. I walk up the steep climbs, you know, open up a little bit on the descents, but like for the most part, it's like breathing easy. You could talk if you wanted to. Like, it's really easy to stay in zone 2, I think, if you're just going off of RPE, versus it gets a little more nuanced and sometimes it can fluctuate a little bit with heart rates. And actually, I find like if I'm trying to hit like my running zone 2, top of my running zone 2 is like 152 beats per minute. And that's like actually feels really hard. Like, that's harder than I actually even want to go. Whereas if I keep it at like 135 or 140, that's like the sweet spot for me. So I don't even mess with the top of zone 2. And it's like just really easy to do that off of RPE. So I find that that's helpful to know what each of, you know, maybe every 10 beats or so within that zone 2, what that feels like, and correlate that to RPE. And that can be really helpful, especially if you're trail running. It's really hard to just keep looking down at your watch the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say too, I kind of like the idea of hiking. I'm guessing if you're hiking with your paragliding equipment, mm-hmm. that's going to be like a pretty heavy pack. I just like that concept of kind of rucking style pack hiking. I've done that with some of my athletes that want to mix things up in the base season or even in the off season and want to mix in some different modalities. But, you know, hiking without any pack on your back is probably going to be more of a zone one activity unless you're at really high elevation or climbing up really steep trails. It's just going to be too low for what we're looking for. So throwing a 30 to 60 pound pack on your back, though, like that'll raise your heart rate enough and get you into that zone too. So I kind of like that idea. And it's good for when you put that 5 pound hydration pack on your back during a mountain bike race, it feels like nothing.
Yeah, they have these things where you can like basically turn your child into a backpack, and we would go hiking with our kid on our back or on our chest. You've seen those things. You're basically turning your kid into a rucksack, and it's great because they get to enjoy the outdoors with you, and you get a zone two hiking experience.
Yeah, no, it was funny. A few weeks ago, one of my buddies posted something about like, super stoked, just got into rucking. And I was like, nah, dude, I've been rucking for 3 years. Put that kid on your back.
Nice.
Cool. I think that pretty much answers the question here. Let's move on to the next one. This one, their name is not included. They just put the town that they live in instead of their name. Oh, wait.
Hey, that's cool. Maybe. Where do they live? Tell us the town.
Okay, no, never mind. Because it says, oh, I see. Nope, their name is Burge, and then they put South Carolina after that. The way that they put a comma, so it looked like Burge, South Carolina was like the town.
Mm.
But their name is Burge.
Okay.
I apologize if I mispronounced that. How do you feel for an early morning ride? I would like to start riding before going to work every day, which would mean I would have to start my ride around 5:30 a.m. and finish around 7 a.m. But how do I fuel for the ride, or can I fuel after the ride? So first off, I would say fueling before, during, and after your rides are three separate categories. Before your ride is going to be like topping off your glycogen stores or giving yourself like preloading your body with energy for your workout. And that usually has to happen depends on the kind of workout. If you're just doing like an endurance ride, it can actually kind of happen anytime before. But if you're doing like a hard workout, an intensity session, probably 2 hours or more before, just to like give your body a chance to digest it fully. There's also going to be, if you're eating some like high carb meal, like a oatmeal or cereal or rice or something like that, you're going to also have like a glycogen spike and then a fall off, and you're going to actually like feel a little bit tired, and you don't want to start your workout in that valley. Like you want to wait till your glycogen kind of levels out again, or glucose levels level out again. So you kind of like timing is a little tricky, and that gets really tricky when you're talking about a 5:30 a.m. start. And that's where I would look into like that second category, which is fueling during your ride. And I'd say that's probably going to be your primary form of nutrition to support your ride here. And then after your ride is going to be whatever you need to replenish those stores, some protein, fair bit of carbs, depending on how hard the ride was, and just something generally fairly healthy to kind of start your day. But what do you guys like? If you were going to start your ride at 5:30 a.m., how would you go about fueling for that?
I'm not waking up 2 hours before that. I'm telling you that right now.
Most people aren't. That's tough.
Maybe waking up 30 to 45 minutes before that and probably just down in a banana as soon as I wake up before mm-hmm. I get ready to where like I maximize the amount of time I have to digest that. Mm-hmm. But maybe like a banana and a granola bar, something small and like super easy to digest. And I'm not going to like eat to get full. I'm just eating to like, yeah, just to get some carbs before the workout. But then if I'm doing a workout, I would definitely have flow formulas in my bottle, like a normal mix, like 60 to 90 carbs, depending on kind of how hard the workout is, but probably closer to 90 if it's a hard workout. Cause then, yeah, I'm
yeah. Cause we're talking an hour and a half here.
So probably 90 carbs in the bottle to get through that workout. And then probably going to be pretty hungry when you get done. Cause like a banana is not going to really fill you up, but it will give you enough to get through that workout. And then probably eating a lot more food after the workout. Personally, I don't know if that's like if that would get me an A on the test or not, but that's what I would do.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty sound. How about you, Kaylin?
I don't have a lot of experience because I, too, am not waking up that early for a workout. But I have had a handful of events start at 6 a.m. And for that, I'm waking up at 3,
yeah,
having breakfast.
An event is different. Yeah,
at like 3:30, 4 o'clock.
Yeah. Especially if your event's starting at 6 a.m., that means it's probably a long event. You know, it's not like a cross-country race that's going to start that early. It's going to be a pretty long endurance event. So, yeah, you definitely want to fuel before that.
The first time I did Unbound, if you stay in the dorms, you get, they have like a cafeteria. It's like a college dorm. So like, and everybody eats at the cafeteria. And I remember being down there at like 4 a.m. because the race starts at 6 or 6:30 or something like that. And like, it was already packed when I got there. And I was like, we're crazy. Like this many people waking up at 4 a.m. to get in there, breakfast for this race. It just was bizarre.
And I think it's so different when you're doing it for an event, because you can get through that for one day for an event. And like, it's a big deal. So you don't want to miss that meal.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about doing this 5 days a week, you know, you're not going to want to compromise 2 hours of sleep just to get that extra meal in. You know, you could try it once to see if there's an performance improvement, but my guess would be actually for this short of a workout, there's probably not. You're probably not going to perform much, if any, different. And the nice thing is starting at 5:30 a.m. means whatever time you finished eating dinner the night before, let's say you finish eating at 7:30, 8 o'clock, I would say don't err on finishing your dinner too early. Like, give yourself a little bit of flexibility or freedom to eat either post-dinner snack or push that dinner out to later, just so it's closer to your start time. But the nice thing is, like, you're pretty much just sleeping from the time you finish your meal, maybe you have an hour or two before bed, and then you're sleeping until you wake up and do your workout. So if you top off your glycogen stores the night before, even if you're doing an intensity workout, it's going to be pretty well topped off still. You're not going to be super depleted. I know you could still technically call this like a fasted ride, but the classification for that typically is going to be like 12 hours or more fasted. So like, that would mean you finish your last meal at 5:30, which is pretty early. So I would say in this case here, like, I would worry less about fueling before, maybe like Drew said, a banana, something that's easy. And I would just consider that more of just your ride fuel. So, you know, you're kind of doing that as you're prepping for your ride, just similar as you would taking a gel 15 minutes before the start of a race. It's just kind of like part of your ride fuel. And then, yeah, lean more on to just the during the ride workout meal. Or nutrition. So, and I wouldn't worry about that being gels and drink mix, and like, keep with whatever your typical ride nutrition would be. I wouldn't get in the mindset of like, oh, I should try and eat oatmeal during my, you know, workout, because it's like, I don't want to start my day with a high carb drink mix. Don't worry about that. Worry about just fueling your workout as you need to, and then get that nice nutritious meal afterwards where you're getting, some more quality nutrients in.
In Racing Weight by Matt Fitzgerald, really good book. You guys should all read it. He has this, he created his own nutrition tracking app called DQS, Diet Quality Score. And it's made mainly to track your quality, not like calories or. So, but one of the things on there, or one of the rules within the DQS is that when you, what's the word? Ergonomic aids, I think that's the word, is like when you're on the bike and you're eating to fuel your ride, that is the one time where you don't keep track of either the amount, or like, you don't track that because you're using it while you ride. And so there is a loophole to like eating donuts, and it's eating donuts while you're riding. And then those don't have a negative effect on your DQS score for the day. I'm being kind of sarcastic, but yeah, to what Adam said, when you're eating to fuel your rides, it's almost like you don't have to count that towards your, you don't have to think so badly about that because you're using that energy.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say too, for maybe some of your endurance rides, you know, you don't even need that banana before, and you can probably reduce it, you know, your carb intake. I think you'll just find that you don't, because you're starting so early, you probably will find that you won't need it as much. You don't need to lean on it as much as you think. I would really focus on fueling for your high intensity workouts and then really focus on your post recovery, your post workout recovery meal. That's going to set you up for good quality, consistent efforts day in, day out, whether it's endurance or high intensity training. You know, and that's going to be more important, I would say, on those endurance days, is making sure you're getting a nice, good quality recovery meal afterwards.
I would have said the total opposite. See, you said before your endurance ride, you might not even need that banana. I look at that as, well, if I'm not riding that hard, I can definitely like squeeze in my oats before I ride and get a full-blown meal.
Yeah, I mean, you say if on an endurance ride, so like on a high intensity, this is probably just 1 or 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking like Monday to Friday. Maybe 1 or 2 of those days are high intensity, but the other days are probably endurance or recovery. For those days, I'd like literally wake up, chamois right on, and I'm eating breakfast at the beginning of my ride, probably. Like just
like you're gonna eat oatmeal, you're saying.
Yeah, like while I'm riding, I mean you're not gonna be going hard enough.
Not
like
while I'm riding, but
yeah, you can do that though. Like at a, you know, 130 beats per minute heart rate, like normal endurance. That's my endurance heart rate.
Yeah.
I could eat whatever I wanted at that heart rate.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, those are, I don't know that I would eat oatmeal. I think it'd be hard to do.
Practically
but
be easy.
Those are like a bagel or something, you know, or
yeah, bagel.
Toast and jelly, something yeah. like that. That's pretty simple. Like it's not going to completely, you know, you're not going to want to make a gigantic omelet or something probably. Like that sounds like it would maybe upset your stomach a bit, but something that's pretty easy to take in, easy to, you know, package or however you need to.
Take a slice of white bread, put Nutella on one half of it and peanut butter on the other half, and then just stick a banana in the middle and you got like a banana burrito breakfast right there.
Sure.
It's so good. Caitlin's yeah. like shaking her head. Why? Because Nutella's the devil.
Oh,
like
what's Nutella's wrong? Just duh.
Yeah, I knew you were gonna say that. Nutella's so good before workout, dude. It's all sugar.
It's so yeah, it's
the number
so
one ingredient is
sweet.
Sugar.
It's not even tasty.
I know, it's so good. But the banana's healthy, so it makes it all healthy. The banana pulls the weight.
But since running more, man, I really appreciate how much better like my gut is for riding, because it's like, yeah, I can eat a bowl of oats and then 30 minutes later be doing an endurance ride like it's nothing. Sadly mistaken, sadly not the case for running. Like,
yeah, no way.
Oh, it's terrible. You need at least 2-2.5 hours after a meal to go for a run. Not great.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing I would mention to this guy is don't compromise sleep. If you are waking up early to do these workouts, make sure you're going to bed early. I've got a guy who's training for RAM, the Ride Across America, a Race Across America. Sweet. And he's been waking up at like, literally, there's been times where his workout starts at 4 a.m. And like the number one thing I keep telling him is like, dude, do not compromise sleep. He said he's even got his wife like making sure he goes to bed early on those days. And I was like, all right, dude. But like if you are only getting 4 or 5 hours or 6 or less, like anything less than 7 hours to me is like a red flag. If you're getting less than 7 hours of sleep, then I don't know if like doing that early morning workout is, I don't know if the negative effects of lack of sleep are going to outweigh the positive benefits of getting that workout in. Like you're compromising maybe too much.
It really comes down to how much training do you need, you know, at that point, and like what can you fit in? It's a really tricky line to balance, though, I would say. Yeah. So for this listener here, starting at 5:30, riding till 7, you know, I mean, you're only talking an hour and a half workout. So hopefully you're not compromising more than maybe an hour of sleep. Like instead of getting 8 hours, maybe you're getting 7 hours now, which seems pretty reasonable to go to bed at 10:30 or, you know, 10 o'clock, wake up at 5 o'clock. That seems pretty reasonable for most people. It depends on everyone's situation, obviously. But I'm guessing if you're able to kind of restructure your day to where you can start your workout at 5:30, you're not concerned here. Like your question had nothing to do with, you know, are you getting enough sleep? Should you get more sleep? That kind of thing. It's more about nutrition. I would guess like it's pretty reasonable to expect that you're not compromising too much sleep. So I would agree with that. Now, if someone needs to get a 5-hour workout in before their day job, because that's just what they're training for and that's the only time they can do it, yeah, you might have to get by on 4 hours of sleep sometimes because you need that extra training volume in, but that's a different, totally different scenario.
Yeah. if somebody had to get 5 hours of training, I would just say ride an hour before work, ride at lunch, ride 2 hours after work, and then no. ride. You know? And then by the end of the day, you'll end up with, with 5 hours. You can pull the 4 days.
All right, cool.
Wrap it there?
Yeah, we can wrap it there. We did have some feedback from a listener. If you guys want to hear that. So this is from...
Is it good or bad?
No, it's good. This is Andrew following up from... Andrew had sent in the question about elevation training and going to like a secret spot somewhere high in the mountains that they could train for a month. And they wanted to know, like, remember back, it's probably 3 weeks ago or 3 or 4 weeks ago, they were asking like, how should they structure their training to make sure that when they come home, they still have top end form to do like XC workouts and stuff or XC races and stuff. So let me just read it real quick. Andrew says, "Hey, thanks guys. Send me a link, a Venmo link. I owe you boys a little donation for responding to my 900 plus word count question about Colorado elevation training." So the super top secret, actually Blaine might've been on for this one. Now that I think about it,
I wasn't here for this. Yeah, one, you went so on for this him, one. Yeah.
He was Blaine. So super top secret location is Crested Butte, Colorado. Unfortunately, a tough spot to descend much from for lower elevation efforts, but Gunnison is a bit lower and could make the difference for the real hard efforts, which I agree. It's probably 2,000 feet lower, which I think would be adequate here. Mm-hmm. We always poke fun at the self-proclaimed mountain bike capital of the world, kind of a running joke with the locals in CB. You did inspire me to dedicate a good full day to fishing with my kids rather than trying to grind out another route for 2 to 4 hours. Out there, it is nearly impossible to ride a zone 1/zone 2 single track route with the elevation/gnarliness. So I'm lucky to be able to make these first world mistakes. Let's see. Oh, yeah. And then Andrew says, if you see an open location through Lifetime Grand Prix to lodge at the check for the Schwamigan 40, called the Adler Lodge, take it up. Big house on the lake, easy bike to the start finish, cold plunge opportunity. Nate Spratt and Julie M stayed there last year. I don't know. Something about that.
I know Nathan Spratt. He's a local fast guy.
No,
he's not. Nathan Spratt is the...
No, yeah, it's Nate and Mark Spratt are the two brothers.
He's the Ventum guy. Yeah. I do know him,
I think they're
too,
both from Utah.
Yeah, you're right.
They'll probably be at Utah this weekend for you.
Great.
Okay, last thing here. And if you haven't spent much time in Crested Butte, it's well worth the extra couple hours beyond the front range. I always have a couple Todd Wells sightings when his kids race the junior bike week that they put on in CB or put on by CB Devo. Great venue if you have kids in a free week in late June. I've actually been out there for our like quote unquote honeymoon, was in CB and Telluride, and it actually happened during the bike week in Crested Butte, which was super sick. So I've got to experience that. Take care and good luck. Hope you all have an awesome 2024. And I hope to bop into you at the Schwamigan 40 again. So we must have met Andrew at Schwamigan 40 before, which is cool.
So we have a Patreon and all that set up for the Bonk Bros. Maybe we should set that up for the Matchbox. I hadn't thought about that. That'd be cool. Get some merch. Hey, people listen to this podcast too.
Yeah, they do. We should definitely at least get some merch going.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, our numbers have been pretty good.
All right, good.
Our following is increasing.
Keep them coming. Keep them coming, yeah. People. Keep listening.
Yeah, but that was cool. That was cool feedback. Always fun to hear back from repeat listeners. So thanks, Andrew. All right, wrap it up there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds good. We'll see ya. All right, folks, thanks for tuning in for the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast. Like I said at the beginning, you can send any questions or topic suggestions to matchboxpod@gmail.com with email titled The Matchbox Podcast. Links to each of our social media pages can be found in the show notes. Tune in next week for another endurance training-related discussion and learn more about how you can find that extra match for your next big event. Catch y'all soon. Let's go!
Can I trust my coach? That's a good question. And we believe that you should totally be asking that question if you're working with a coach. And when it comes to the coaches at Ignition Coach Co., I like to say the proof is in the pudding. Every single one of our coaches has high levels of racing experience. Or in other words, our coaches are fast.
And if they're fast, then they can make you fast too. I mean, come on, who do you want to be your coach? The guy with a clipboard on the sidelines, or the guy with his hands in the air crossing the finish line? I don't know about you, but I'm going with the winner. Sign up for coaching today at IgnitionCoachCo.com.